Last time I was up here, last time I preached, I introduced a series that I'd been thinking about for a while, which I'm calling Sidekicks. Now, it's a bit of a once-in-a-while thing. I won't be doing it every time I'm up here. But it was a thought I had that there's a whole lot of characters in the Bible, people who have their own amazing stories, or maybe there's things that in their character or things that happen to them that we can learn a lot from. But they never get the top billing. They're always in the shadow of someone else. Excuse me. I need to turn on my technology. These people aren't the main players in their part of the story, but they nonetheless have important stories to tell. A bit like Robin. We never think of Robin in his own... We always speak of Batman and Robin. He's always a part of Batman and Robin. And despite any personal attributes or personal achievements, Robin's always the perpetual offsider, the sidekick to Batman, the better known Batman. And we're talking about people like that in the Bible. In part one of this series, I talked about Jonathan. That was a few weeks ago. Jonathan, a man that could have been king, a man of outstanding faith, courage and humility, but a man living in the shadow of his great friend, David. Today, we're going to be talking about Naomi, not the wonderful young lady sitting up the front here who runs our youth group, amongst other things, but the Naomi that we find in the book of Ruth, a short but really rich book nestled in between the book of Judges and 1 Samuel. The book of Ruth features a number of named characters, and three of them in particular are really important to the narrative. That's Naomi, Ruth, and Boaz. All three play really critical parts in the story, but while you'd probably never call it the book of Boaz, to call it the book of Naomi actually wouldn't be that much of a stretch. Ultimately, though, it's Ruth that gets top billing and naming rights. And rightly so, but it's a pretty close call. Without Naomi, there'd be no book of Ruth at all. And no book of Ruth, well, let's just say the impact would be pretty profound. But I'm getting ahead of myself. So let's meet Naomi. In Ruth chapter 1, verses 1 and 2, we read, isn't that great? In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech. His wife's name was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah. And they went to Moab and lived there. There's a lot going on in those first two verses. First, we're going to take a look at the characters, and in particular their names, because their names are significant. As you'd expect in any text from this period, the first person we meet is the husband, the head of the household, Elimelech. His name means, "My God is King." His wife is Naomi, whose name means pleasant or sweet. The meaning of the names of the two sons is a little less clear, but it's likely that Mahlon means sick, and Chilion may mean pining or wasting away. So if you're looking for a biblical name for your kids, maybe not the ones to choose. But they do turn out to be fairly prophetic. We also read that the family were Ephrathites from Bethlehem. Most of you, I'm guessing, have heard of Bethlehem, but Ephrathites... what the heck are they? Maybe some sort of a cult. Well, it's nothing so deep or interesting, I'm afraid. Ephrath was simply another name for Bethlehem. So it's a bit like saying they were Gisbonites from Gisborne. But the name Bethlehem has a meaning too. Does anyone know what it is? Sue, do you know what it is? Indeed. Bethlehem is made up of two Hebrew words. Beth, meaning house, and Lehem, meaning bread. So Bethlehem means house of bread, which is pretty cool, isn't it? Because around 1200 years later, Bethlehem, the house of bread, became the birthplace of the bread of life. Incidentally, the name Ephrath means fruitful, so it's very much in the same vein. And lastly, we've got Moab. I've got no idea what the name Moab means, but we hear of Moab and its people elsewhere in the Old Testament. The Moabites were descendants of Lot, Abraham's nephew. And you can read in several places of their opposition to the Hebrews, in the book of Numbers and the book of Judges, for example. The Moabites did not worship God, Yahweh. They called their god Chemosh. And it's fairly certain that the worship of Chemosh involved human sacrifice. So there's a famine in the land and in Bethlehem. The house of bread has run out of bread. Elimelech, the man whose name means my God is king, takes his family and leaves the land of his God and king behind. And he heads to a godless place, an enemy country, a country where the one true God is reviled. Now, many of the commentaries that you might read about this will talk about how what Elimelech did was a sin, and how he should have trusted in God rather than act in his own strength. And then they hint, or they say it outright, that the disaster that strikes next is a direct result of that sin. Now, all of that might be correct, but I think it'd be a shame to turn this into a simple morality lesson. Obey God or suffer the consequences. I think there's a lot more going on than that. Elimelech and his family are a lot like you and me, I think, and a lot like the thousands who leave their homes in places right across the world, climb into overcrowded and leaky boats at enormous risk, in the hope of a better life for their families. Things must have been pretty bleak for Elimelech and his family. We know there's a famine in Judah, and we learn later that Elimelech had sold his own land, presumably for the money to allow them to survive a little longer. But now things are so desperate that Elimelech makes the hugely risky decision to move his family to an enemy country just to survive. He wouldn't have made the decision lightly. And yes, it may have been the wrong decision. But I wonder if you or I would have done any differently. Of course, disaster does strike. Is it a direct result of Elimelech's decision? We're not really told. But we read from verses 3-5. Now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. They married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. After they'd lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and husband. So Elimelech, Mahlon and Chilion have all died. Judgment for their sin? Maybe. Might also have been congenital heart disease. I'm not sure that it matters, at least for the purpose of the story. This ultimately isn't a story of God's judgment, but of his sovereignty and his provision. Of course, we should strive to avoid sin and follow God's leading in all parts of our lives. Of course we should. But as Romans 8:28 tells us, God can also use our mistakes. Romans 8:28, and we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. That verse was written several hundred years after the events we're talking about here, but right at that moment, I think Naomi would have found them quite comforting. Have you ever heard the expression, it never rains, but it pours? Yeah. One has. Good on you, Morris. I think we most of us probably have. Naomi is living that right now. She's in the midst of absolute personal disaster. In those days, there wasn't too much, there weren't too many worse situations than to be a childless widow. I've heard Naomi referred to as the female equivalent of Job. At this point, she's literally lost everything. Naomi hears that the famine is over in Judah, so she decides to return home. Not that there's much there for her to return to. And her two daughters-in-law set out with her, but twice she stops and tries to encourage them to go back to their own people. She places their welfare above her own. Orpah decides to return, but Ruth makes it clear she's staying with Naomi. And from verses 16 to 18, we read, "But Ruth replied, 'Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go, and where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me.'" When Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. Quite an amazing speech from Ruth. And I think it tells us just as much about Naomi as it does about Ruth. It's important to understand here what Ruth is committing herself to. She's committing herself to heading to Judah with her penniless mother-in-law, where she'll not only be a penniless widow herself, but also an unwelcome alien, almost certainly subject to intolerance and prejudice, but also at great risk of violence. So why is she going? Well, firstly, I think it's pretty clear that she's doing it out of love and loyalty to Naomi, and that alone speaks volumes about Naomi's character. But another clue, I think, is in her final sentence. "May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." The word translated Lord here is the Hebrew word Yahweh, the name of God. Ruth isn't referring to Naomi's God. She's clearly naming her own God, Yahweh. In the course of her relationship with Naomi, through spending time with her and most likely watching the way in which she dealt with her personal tragedy, Ruth has taken Naomi's God as her own. They didn't have the benefit of the temple and teaching, but over time, Ruth has caught, if you like, Naomi's faith. And Ruth isn't just paying lip service. She's prepared to face poverty, starvation, prejudice, and potentially violence for the sake of her faith and for love of her mother-in-law. Rather than return to physical comfort and security among the godless members of her own country, she's choosing the land of her newfound God with all the risks that that brings. Ruth's conversion, I think, speaks to the critical importance of personal relationship in bringing others to God. Because we can run all the programs in the world. We can bring in inspirational speakers. We can give people great books to read. But it's in relationship, real relationship, where people see how we live and where they see how our faith informs the way we live, where people experience our genuine care, where we give them real time and real attention, where we earn the right to speak into their situations, to do life with them through the ups and downs and answer their questions, pray for them and ultimately with them. It's those real relationships that are going to have the most impact for the kingdom of God. I'm going to branch away from my notes here for a moment because I've just found this in my pocket, this little piece of Lego. And I was at an in-service course last week that I have to attend for accreditation as a Churches of Christ minister. But the speaker gave us this gift. We all got a little bit of Lego. Some were bigger and some were smaller. And it was to remind us, he said, keep it in your pocket. And you feel it there in your pocket. And it's to remind you that every time you have an interaction with someone, they're giving you a gift. And the gift might not, it might have knobs on it and it might be, you know, uncomfortable. They're giving you a gift and you need to use that gift, take that gift and ask them about it. Why is it like that? Why are you like that? Why are you telling me this right now? And engage with those people. Take the gift and use it to develop relationship. Get yourself a piece of Lego. For Ruth, Naomi was that person. Naomi was that person that listened with her, that sat with her, that developed that relationship with her, that ultimately drew Ruth to God. So we're still in chapter 1, so we better move along. In verses 19 to 21, we read, so the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the woman exclaimed, can this be Naomi? Don't call me Naomi, she told them. Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. So Naomi, sweet, pleasant Naomi, has become Mara. Her new name literally means bitter. Bitterness is her new identity. I think it's important to note, though, that she hasn't rejected God. He's still the Almighty, but she feels afflicted by him. Now, and I think this is really precious. If you're well-versed in your Old Testament, you're going to recognize an echo in those last verses. An echo from Exodus 15. And in verses 22 to 25 of Exodus 15, we read, then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. For 3 days they travelled in the desert without finding water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink its water because it was bitter. That is why the place is called Marah. So the people grumbled against Moses, saying, what are we to drink? Then Moses cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water, and the water became fit to drink. The ESV translation renders verse 25 as, and he cried to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a log, and he threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. So she doesn't know it yet, but the Lord is about to throw a log and restore bitter Mara back into sweet Naomi. Chapter 1 concludes, So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. So we come to chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side, a man of standing from the clan of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth the Moabite said to Naomi, let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favour. What Ruth is proposing is a practice that was known as gleaning, which originated in God's law. For example, in Leviticus chapter 19, verses 9 and 10. When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings from your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the foreigner. I am the Lord your God. God created a system of social security and communal provision for the poor long before anyone thought of New Start or the age pension. And Ruth intended to avail herself of that provision on behalf of herself and Naomi. And that wasn't without risk. Firstly, Ruth would be a young woman alone in a paddock full of predominantly male workers. Add to that the fact that she was a native of a hated rival country, and the risk of violence and abuse was really high. But their need was great. So Ruth set out to the fields. Luckily, and for those listening to the recording I've just done, air quotation marks, luckily, Ruth chooses to glean in the field of Boaz, a kinsman. Luckier still, Boaz notices Ruth and asks his overseer, who does that young woman belong to? Try getting away with that question nowadays. Anyway, Boaz had already heard about Naomi's return and about all that Ruth had been doing for her mother-in-law. And he's very impressed. So on hearing that it's Ruth out gleaning in his field, he takes her under his protection, ensures that she's safe and that she can glean far more than you would normally expect. When she got home, Naomi was amazed at how much she had gleaned. And in verses 19 and 20, we read, her mother-in-law asked, where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz, she said. The Lord bless him, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. She added, that man is our close relative. He is one of our guardian redeemers. Now, the concept of guardian redeemer comes from Leviticus chapter 25, verse 25. If one of your fellow Israelites becomes poor and sells some of their property, their nearest relative is to come and redeem what they have sold. Again, we've got God's law setting up a type of social safety net, a system of social justice embodied in the law. So at this point, you can almost hear the wheels turning in Naomi's head. Maybe God hasn't abandoned them. To add the overarching concern of God for the poor, the disadvantaged and the foreigner, which is embodied in his law, to the coincidence of Ruth stumbling on the field of a potential redeemer and a redeemer that has already looked kindly on Ruth. Maybe there's actually a way out of this mess. So she tells Ruth to continue gleaning only in the fields of Boaz. Certainly for Ruth's safety, but maybe already with a larger plan in mind. Which brings us to chapter 3. And in verses 1 to 4, we read, one day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, my daughter, I must find a home for you, where you'll be well provided for. Now, Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight, he'll be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. Wash, put on perfume, and get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. When he lies down, note the place where he's lying. Then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. Now, all this probably sounds a little bizarre to us, but it was a different time and a different culture. What Naomi's telling Ruth to do effectively is to offer herself in marriage to Boaz without actually proposing to him, because that wouldn't have been appropriate. At this point, I find myself reminded of two parables that Jesus told, the parable of the talents from Matthew 25 and the parable of the shrewd manager from Luke 16. Naomi's looking at what's in her hands, and at this stage, it's God's law and a sympathetic guardian redeemer. She's moving on from the victim mentality she had at the start of, or the end of chapter 1. And she's actively working for the welfare, both of herself and Ruth. God has provided an opportunity, and she's grabbing onto it with both hands. It's pretty tempting when we're beset by problems just to wallow and wait for God to bail us out, or not. But Jesus' parables tell us not to squander what's already in our hands, to work along with him. One of my favourite couple of verses from Isaiah 43:18-19 says, "Forget the former things. Do not dwell in the past. See, I am doing a new thing. Now it springs up. Do you not perceive it? I'm making a way in the wilderness and streams in the wasteland." God's doing a new thing for Naomi and Ruth. He's made a way in the wilderness. Ruth has perceived it, and she's determined that they'll take it. So chapter 4 largely then recounts the process Boaz had to go through to confirm himself as the guardian redeemer, so he could then propose to and ultimately marry Ruth. In verses 13-17, we read, "So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife. When he made love to her, the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son. The woman said to Naomi, 'Praise be to the Lord, who this day has not left you without a guardian redeemer. May he become famous throughout Israel. He will renew your life and sustain you in your old age. For your daughter-in-law, who loves you and who is better to you than seven sons, has given him birth.' Then Naomi took the child in her arms and cared for him. The women living there said, 'Naomi has a son,' and they named him Obed. He was the father of Jesse, the father of David." So bitter Mara is now sweet Naomi again. The Lord has redeemed her through her daughter-in-law, Ruth, through a guardian redeemer, Boaz, and now through their son, Obed, who we later see in the genealogies of the true redeemer, Christ. Remember Romans 8:28. "In all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who've been called according to his purpose." Somehow, God took a famine, three untimely deaths, poverty and hopelessness, not only worked them for the good of Naomi and Ruth, but then worked that good into his amazing plan of salvation for all of us. I love the book of Ruth. Firstly, because of the quirkiness of the story and the odd customs and the names that I have to go and research. And mostly because of the wonderful illustration of God's sovereignty in each and every situation and the vivid display of his love and provision. But I also love it because of the example of Naomi, a woman whose friendship and loving example causes a pagan to become part of God's family, a woman who, despite enormous personal tragedy, sees beyond her pain and bitterness, discerns the hand of God at work in her life, and grasps the opportunity as God's brought her way. A woman of faith, whose faith, shrewdness, perseverance and determination enable her story to be woven into God's grand rescue story. Sweet Naomi, who becomes bitter Mara, and then by the grace of God is transformed back into sweet Naomi. As I said earlier, I think the book is rightly called the Book of Ruth. But without Naomi, there'd be no Book of Ruth. What if Naomi had just allowed her grief to overwhelm her? What if she just let herself waste away in Moab? Well, Job 42 tells us that God's plans can't be thwarted, but things certainly would have looked a little different. Naomi shows us that God can take our bit of faith and our obedience. He can use our lives as insignificant as we might think they are. Yes, he can use our failures and our mistakes, but even more so, our determination, our triumphs, our friendships, our love, our compassion. And he can weave them into his plan for something far, far greater than we could ever imagine. And who wouldn't want to be a part of that? Wes, do you want to go grab the worship team? Thanks. So I was going to finish up about there. But then I realised there's a bit of a postscript that I want to add. See, much as I love the story, the book overall, there's one thing that I find quite unsatisfying about the book of Ruth. And I find the same thing unsatisfying about the book of Job. Both of these stories of tragedy, trial and ultimate triumph end effectively with, and they all lived happily ever after. But Naomi lost her husband and two sons. Lot lost seven sons and three daughters. Yes, the Lord provided new children and new grandchildren. Yes, he created, provided greater prosperity and any number of things to be joyful about. But you don't ever completely get over losses like that, do you? You don't truly live happily ever after. The joy for Naomi and for Lot would always be tinged with sadness, always with an ache, a sense of loss. But the truly wonderful thing is that our loving God is ever present and ever faithful in that place too. Thank you.